This is the Hidden Wire podcast, episode 510, with best-selling author Catherine Price.
Your life is what you pay attention to. That's kind of one of my favorites right now.
Hey, welcome to the Hidden Wire podcast. How are you? My name is Lee Mottlety, the host of the show. I hope you're well, guys. This is the first episode of the year. I just had a couple of weeks off myself. I hope you have as well. I hope you had a great Christmas and New Year's break, celebrations, etc. Time to reflect, time to spend with your loved ones, etc., etc. And ready to get back into the new year. I'm fired up and ready to go. I've got some new plans this year. But to kick it off this year, I'm starting with the interview, the long format interviews that I do every Monday from now on. And this interview I did with Catherine Price. She is the author of her newest book, How to Break Up with Your Phone, The 30-Day Plan to Taking Back Your Life. It's coming out next month, guys. So if you'd like to support the show and support Catherine, check out that book and pick up a copy of the book using the links at thehiddenwhy.com. So you're probably wondering, well, what is this all about? It's not quick tips and advice on how to stop using your phone. It's really deeper than that. It's how to redevelop that relationship with your phone. And it sounds strange, but if you think about it, the phones that we have these days, they consume us. I mean, you go out there and everyone's on these phones. They're looking, walking around, looking down at their phone. They're driving, looking at their phone. They're out at restaurants and dinners, at movies. Everywhere we go, we can see people using their phones. And I'm certainly guilty as of that. And if the average is a true indication of your situation, that suggests that we spend 4 hours cumulative each day on our phones. And that's a huge amount of time to be spending on your phones. And if you add that up, I think Catherine did the calculation for us in this interview, but it adds up to like, I don't know, 30 weeks or something of a full-time job, which is a huge amount of time. And you wonder how that affects our productivity. You wonder how that affects our level of well-being, our state of happiness, and the quality of life that we live. And I think, from my perspective, it's probably not doing us much good at the moment. Now, I don't think technology is a bad thing. I think technology is absolutely beneficial, can provide us with great convenience, and it can help improve our lifestyles in a lot of senses as well. But there's a certain level to the addiction and consuming qualities of these phones that we perhaps need to break free from. And that's what this is really about. It's deeper than just quick tips and advice on how to stop using your phone. She goes deeper and she shares a lot of great value. I really loved this conversation with Catherine. It was beautiful. Got a lot out of it myself. So I hope you do too, guys. That is it. I'll let you get into the show with Catherine Price. Before we go there, guys, just a reminder, the schedule has changed slightly for this year. So every Monday I'll be releasing my long format interview with a special guest. On Wednesday, I do my solo rant, my solo show, where I share some value and something that I've learned, something that I've been thinking about. On Friday, I've got my new segment, so I still bring on a guest interview, but it's a 30-minute quicker power segment designed to just really explore one topic in depth so we can get some value out of that and hopefully use it in some way, shape, or form to benefit our lives. And then on Saturday, I do my book reflection. I've still got my blogs every Tuesday as per it has been for the last couple of years. And that's it. That's it for me. I've cancelled the 3-minute thought. And that'll be sort of incorporated in the solo rant now anyway. So that's the schedule moving forward, guys. As always, if you love any of the episodes you listen to, please do me a favour. Share it with your friends, family. Share the love. That'd be great. You can also leave us a review on iTunes anytime you wish. And if you want to support the show, you can use the Amazon and Audible links within the show notes to do all your shopping on Amazon and get any books that you might be interested in that I review or otherwise mention here at thehiddenwhy.com. So that's it from me, guys. Enjoy the show. Make sure you check out my new book too, The Ultimate Life Map. Go to theultimatelifemap.com, put in your email address there so you can get a copy when that comes out as well, which will, at some stage, be released this year. So keep an eye out for that as well. Guys, thank you for tuning in. Hope you're well. Hope you have a good day and enjoy this interview with best-selling author Catherine Price. Body was poor. We had a bit of internet connectivity problems. And my microphone, I just reinstalled my system here on my laptop, and my microphone wasn't connected correctly, so it recorded through my computer mic, which the audio quality is a lot worse than my typical Blue Yeti mic. So apologies for that. Let's get into the show.
Hello.
Catherine Price, welcome to the Hidden Wire podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
We are recording and we are live. Thank you for taking the time out. I know you're busy.
Oh, no problem. I'm excited.
Busy writer, got a new book. Coming out February, isn't it?
Yes, in February 13th in the US.
So whereabouts are you located? Philadelphia, is that right?
Yes, I am in Philadelphia.
A place that you highly recommend. Why is that?
I do recommend it because it is full of activities and good restaurants and very convenient to transportation to many places around the country, and yet is much, much, much cheaper than New York or DC.
Yeah, right. Okay, cool. I've never been to the States. I've got to get myself there at some stage because I talk to a bucket load of people from there. So,
yes, yes. Are you in Japan right now?
Yeah, we're in Japan. We're just about to move home to Australia in about 3 weeks. So, here sort of packing and rejigging our lives around.
Gotcha.
So looking forward to it. So, Will, thank you, yeah, again for coming on the show. I appreciate you taking the time out. And, I want to really discuss your book today and a couple of your other books as well. You're a bit of a writer, aren't you? You're a journalist?
I am a journalist, yes.
Okay, and how long have you been in this profession for?
Pretty much my whole career. I was a teacher briefly after college, and then I've been a freelance writer ever since then.
So how does one get into freelance writing with an ability to make a lifestyle?
Well, I personally picked the exact worst time to decide to pursue that career because it was around 2002. So it was just as the publishing industry was really collapsing. I tutored for a while to make ends meet while I was getting started. And then I did basically try to cast my net wide in terms of doing stuff besides just writing. And now I'm kind of transitioned into book writing, which has been more fun, I must say, than writing for magazines. Now, to apologize, I have a cold from my daughter, which I'm realizing is apparent as I'm speaking. So I'm not normally cool. Stuffed up.
I've been through that, so I know what that's like. Cool. So you did some tutoring just to get by at the start, I assume in line with what you taught at schools.
Well, yes, the tutoring actually came first. So I was a Latin and a math tutor, even though I did not take Latin or math in college. That was all just left over from high school. I thought that I would be tutoring English or writing or something like that. But it turns out in New York, there is a much higher market or bigger market. I was in New York at the time for Latin and math tutors. And I grew up in New York, and many of the prep schools there require you to take Latin, and most kids suck at Latin. And so those two things together were an excellent business opportunity.
Yeah, wow. Okay. So there's probably a little bit to unpack there, but yet you sort of had to do a bit of tutoring to get by while you worked on this passion of writing of yours. Is that right?
Yes, while I was getting started.
Okay, and I think that's important for a lot of people to understand that, you know, you can't just jump straight into something that you love. It takes a gradual process maybe to build up and create that lifestyle that you want.
I think so. I mean, and it certainly depends on whether or not the industry that you love is dying or not.
Right.
Not to get too sad about it, but, you know,
No, it's true. You've got to be aware of these things, don't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and you're a mum of how many kids?
Just one.
Just one, cool.
She's about two and a half.
Two and a half, okay. Well, that keeps you busy.
And very
as well.
Contagious, apparently.
Yeah, right. So do you self-publish? Or actually, I think I know that you go through traditional publishers. Is that right?
Yes, I go through traditional publishers. The book that I have coming out in February, which is called How to Break Up with Your Phone, is 10-Speed Press. And then my previous was Penguin Press. And then I've done some stuff with HarperCollins. Although at this point, it seems like most of those are all owned by the same master company. But technically, the books have been with different publishers. But yes, I have an agent. And in terms of the how-to portion of it, I got an agent who represents me and then represents my book proposals and sells them to publishers.
Right. So is that something that you can do? I'm a publisher as well, and I've just got a book in my hands at the moment that I want to publish. So this is relevant for me and my interest, but perhaps some of the audience out there have a book that they want to publish as well. How do you go about acquiring an agent?
Well, it depends in part on whether or not you're doing fiction or nonfiction. I mean, in general, so I'm speaking from the nonfiction perspective. I got an agent after I had written enough stuff to they call it a platform, which is one of those industry terms that gets annoying after you hear it for a while.
Right.
But once you can demonstrate that you have enough stuff published, that you have some credibility in the field, and also if you have a proposal in hand, that's what you need to do to have in order to shop for an agent. And with fiction, my understanding is that many times people will approach agents with a finished manuscript. I actually interned at a literary agency once when I was in college, and so they had a lot of people sending in unsolicited manuscripts trying to get an agent for their work.
Yep.
With nonfiction, it's more a proposal that you would be showing the agent, and that the agent would be showing to the potential publisher, and they would try to sell the proposal to the publisher as opposed to the finished product. But I can say definitely from the perspective of an intern at a literary agency, they get a ton of these unsolicited manuscripts, and they go into what's called the slush pile. And it's extremely rare for anything to get picked out of the slush pile. So that's not really a very good way to get an agent.
Yeah, fair enough. Makes sense. As a recruiter or past recruiter, I know what it can be like to get lots of resumes coming through and how you come through them. You know, you got to put them in a pile somewhere, and that pile obviously often doesn't get a look in. Okay. Interesting stuff. So you've got a new book coming out. So it's How to Break Up With Your Phone and Get Your Life Back, which is probably of interest to a lot of people out there at the moment because it's so consuming.
It resonates with a lot of people. It's been very interesting to see the conversations around this topic really be beginning to pick up. Just today I was in the car and I was listening to the radio, and there was an entire radio show. I think it's called the 1A. It's a new show here in the States. That was all about phones and schools and whether or not phones should be allowed in schools and the impact on education and technology addiction and all this stuff. So it's very timely, and I really do hope it will resonate with people because it certainly has helped my life to go through this process of reevaluating my relationship with my phone.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, Catherine, I've just got some internet connectivities there. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you.
You can hear me? Okay. Hopefully that doesn't play up. Sorry, guys, for you listening out there. you've written a book that you hope that resonates with a lot of people. I believe it will resonate with a lot of people because I myself, and I can see a lot of people out there, we just are, totally addicted to these phones, and they do seem to start to control our life. It's something that we seem to not be able to let go to. And I know you're into mindfulness as well, and there's probably the correlation there to your work, I assume. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think, to take a step back. So the point of the book is, despite the title of Breaking Up With Your Phone, it's not actually to dump your phone entirely. No. It's basically to create a healthier relationship with it. So I like to say, if you say you're breaking up with your boyfriend or girlfriend, that doesn't mean that you're never going to date anyone again. It just means you decided that this is not the best relationship for you and you'd like something different. So the point is to help people create a healthier relationship because, in all honesty, these devices are not going away and they obviously have many good things about them. It's not an entirely bad equation. Otherwise, they wouldn't be so popular.
I agree.
And they're very useful. So my hope is that people will be able to kind of use this book as a guide to actually restructure that relationship. And to talk about what your reference to mindfulness, I've found that there's a lot of talk and articles right now about how to spend less time on your phone. But they're normally in the form of just simple tips, like 5 tips to spend less time on your phone. But they never really get at this broader question of why you're on the phone to begin with. And so one thing I think that makes my book different that I hope will help people is that it really is rooted in mindfulness practice. So basically, at its core, cultivating a more mindful awareness of when you're using your phone, why you're using your phone, and asking yourself whether or not that's actually what you want to be spending your time on in that moment. So the question that drives the book is basically, what do you want to pay attention to? And the reasoning behind that is that in our lives, our experience is entirely defined by what we're paying attention to. Like right now I'm talking to you on this podcast and I'm staring out the window at a tree and like nothing else in the world exists right now. This is what I will remember from this moment. And I'm very happy to be spending my moment this way, speaking with you. When I'm on my phone, I'm not experiencing anything else other than what I'm looking at on that little screen. And that's neither good nor bad. But it is what it is. And so for myself, realize that I really should be constantly coming back to this question of what do I want to be paying attention to?
Yeah.
And if what I'm paying attention to is not what I want to pay attention to, then okay, maybe I want to change what I'm doing so that I'm actually directing my precious attention towards something I actually find fulfilling or meaningful.
Yeah, and it relates to productivity as well. I mean, that's generally how people are productive is based on how they use their energy and attention, or how they choose to manage their attention and energy.
Right. And one of the things I tutored was Latin. And so attention actually comes from the words that mean to stretch towards or to, reach towards. So it's basically, what are you reaching towards? What are you stretching towards in that moment? And You know, there are times when it is my phone, when I do want to be checking something on my phone, but most times if I ask myself that question, it is not actually, you know, whatever it is on that screen.
So do you link that question to sort of, you know, what am I reaching towards, or where's my attention at the moment? And then, you know, backing it up by why. Why is it there, and why is this important to my life?
Why is the activity in question, you mean, important?
Yeah, yeah. Like, why, like if I'm looking on Facebook or I'm jumping onto my phone to check email, you know, to really just have that awareness around, you know, why am I doing this? Why is this important?
And is it important? I guess the other, you know, to me, like, is it? And then
yeah.
I guess the why is a kind of deeper philosophical question you could ask yourself, like, why is it important to me to check Facebook, you know, 30 times a day or whatever it is? But the first thing to ask yourself is just, what am I doing now? Do I want to be doing that right now? And then I suppose you could ask yourself, why do I keep finding myself drawn to this activity if I determined it's not actually something I want to keep doing?
Just delving it a bit deeper. Okay, well, I like that because, you know, the title alone might give people that impression that this is like a quick 5 tips to break up with your phone, but you certainly go a bit deeper with your research into how it all works, which is absolutely important, because I think there's a lot of, you know, how-tos online these days, you know, how to do this, how to do that, 10 steps, 10 secrets, blah, blah, blah. And if they all work, then we'd all be great, wouldn't we? But I don't know. They seem to be nice and fluffy, but they don't seem to have much depth that allows us to actually make perhaps the changes that we need.
Right. I think also what they don't really deal with is the fact that these devices are designed and apps are designed to be addictive and to keep us on them as long as possible.
Right.
And so you're dealing with an addiction of any kind. Like, you can't just slap a Band-Aid on it and think it's going to go away, which I think is what a lot of the tips, when they're taken in isolation, essentially amount to. So the way I ended up structuring the book is that the first half is called The Wake Up, and that's basically a look into how spending a lot of times on our phones affects us in terms of our brains, our memories, and our abilities to relate with other people and to live fulfilling lives. And then hopefully by that point, I've convinced you that there is reason for concern,
Good.
You know, and then the second half of the book is structured as a 30-day plan to take back your life. You don't really need to do it over 30 days. That's, you know, partly just to give it a nice structure.
Yeah.
Although I will say it does take time, obviously, to change a habit. And so you can't just, as we're talking about, read a list of 10 tricks and then think that you're going to permanently change your behavior. But it was a fun book to write because I actually enlisted the help of all of these guinea pigs. I sent out a note to all these friends, and then they sent out notes to their friends. I actually used social media to recruit people and ended up with like 150 people who agreed to go through this breakup process and give me feedback on the steps. And so that really helped me refine the suggestions I was giving people. And then it also gave me this wonderful trove of quotes of people's experiences that they then excerpted and put throughout the breakup part of the book to give readers a sense of what some other people's experiences were like or what they took away from it. And also to make it seem like, okay, this may be a pain in the butt to do, but it's actually worth it. And here's so-and-so saying it's worth, you know, taking the time to rearrange your apps or whatever the particular step is of that moment.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So with the wake up part, what are some of the, I guess, the why? Why is it something that we might be interested in? And perhaps you can share some statistics around, you know, how we use our phones at the moment and, you know, again, why it's addictive.
Oh, sure. Thankfully, I happen to have a galley right next to me. I just had a little panic moment thinking, I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but I don't need to because I wrote them down in this book. So let me flip to that page.
I always like stats about, you know, how we use our phone, because it sort of does, it's something that we don't think about day to day, you know, because we just jump on and we just do it out of sort of habit and routine. But I've heard some stats which indicate, and then you look at your life and you go, well, hang on, yeah, that's actually pretty true as it relates to my life. And geez, that really does add up, you know?
Right, exactly. I mean, yeah, so I have a bunch of statistics in the book. This is from the American perspective, although I just recently did a bit of research on the British side, because for the British edition, Australia, I think, is just getting the British or the American version. I apologize, but I imagine it would be something similar. But, you know, Americans check their, this is for adults, an average of 47 times a day. And for people who are between 18 and 24, it's closer to 82 times a day.
So what, check their phones?
Yeah, like pick up their phones and check something on it. And I should also say, like, I always look at these statistics and I'm like, okay, you can't actually really put a fine point on the exact number, because they're all based obviously on phone surveys or some kind of survey, but I did my best to find legitimate surveys that seemed like they accurately represented reality.
Yeah, sure. So that's 47 times to 80 times.
I've actually found ones that are higher too. Like some studies have found it to be higher, which is crazy.
Yeah, I have seen some stats in that field too. What does it mean, like, to look? Is it just to look at our phone, or is it actually to click the button and log in?
I believe that is actually to not just check the time, like actually, you know, access the home screen.
Okay. And I wonder, what the average time is. Do you have those stats, like what the average time is that we spend once we do log in?
Well, I found statistics about the average amount of time an American spends on their phone. This is just phones, not like computers. And it's four hours a day or more on their phones.
It's crazy, isn't it, really?
Yes. And then if you do the math on that, that's 28 hours a week and like basically nearly 40 hour work weeks a year on your phone. And I think what
– How many?
It's almost 34 work weeks of 40 hour work weeks a year just spent on your phone.
30. That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, or 56 full 24-hour days. So, you know, just you can do the math. You can kind of decide which makes you feel the worst and pick that metric in terms of how you want to divide up the 4 hours a day. But, I have to say, like, I started using an app called Moment, which works for iPhone. There's another one called OffTime that works for Android. And it will basically keep track of the amount of time you spend on your phone each day. And it's very easy to rack up a couple hours without realizing it. And when I gave that exercise to the guinea pigs for the research portion of this project, I got a lot of feedback from people saying, oh my God, I can't believe how much time Moment is saying I spent on my phone. And then it also tracks how many times you pick up your phone. I can't remember off the top of my head if Moment counts just checking the time as a check. I think it does. But anyway, people were just horrified by it.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good way to start, I guess, with, measuring your own usage.
Right, exactly. I call that a technology triage. It's basically like figuring out like how much time are you actually spending on it? What are your real problem areas that you want to, you know, actually address first? And so, I mean, one person I think put it really well when he said, I'm basically abandoning my life in like 30-second to 5-minute intervals, because Moment will also show you how much time you spent in each of those segments. And so I think, I mean, it's interesting to think, what is more disturbing if you spent like 2 hours on one thing just looking at Facebook, or 2 hours that you spent in like 30-second increments? I mean, I think both are concerning, depending on your...
Yeah, well, that's a tough one, isn't it?
Right? Yeah.
Well, because they say, you know, when you jump from one task to the other, you become less and less effective. Where at least if you're spending 2 hours on Facebook, maybe you're spending a really good effective 2 hours on there for whatever benefits you might get.
What does that mean to be effective, right? Like really checking all the status update, reading every comment? I personally am not really active. I am not active on Facebook. I have an account and I'm sure there's messages in there, but I just basically never check it. And in terms of your question of what else is in that wake up section, you know, I talk about not just the amount of time we spend and the number of times we're checking our phones each day, but I talk about how spending so much time reading stuff online or looking at this kind of information in this context, it really can affect your ability to remember what you read or to keep your train of thought. And also just on a separate note, the way that, what am I trying to say? It had never really occurred to me before I researched the book that getting back to the question of attention, that is what is being sold. I mean, now having done all this research and there's been a lot more talk about this, seems more obvious to me, but I had not thought about the fact that, okay, the reason that social media platforms is free is not because there's some altruistic urge on the part of their creators to help us, like, you know, as I put in the book, share selfies with each other. It's because they want us to devote our attention to our screen so they can show us ads, and they want to collect as much information about us as possible so they can keep us on the app and show us ads. Totally makes sense from a business perspective, but when you start to learn more about the ways that they do that, and they call it brain hacking, it's an industry term, then to me at least it becomes just kind of creepy, or just kind of like, just makes me feel kind of gross. You know, for example, Instagram will hold back your likes, like your own personal likes, until it determines you are about to log off of Instagram, and then it will deliver a chunk of likes to you that's precisely calculated to keep you, Lee, on the phone longer.
Wow.
that moment would be different for me and it'd be different for someone else. So each person has an algorithm that's basically trying to determine exactly when they're the most likely to respond positively in the eyes of Instagram to receiving the likes. And then that's when you get those likes. So there's all sorts of manipulation going on in the back end to keep us on our, on our apps as long as possible. And, you know, and then there's other stuff that, depending on your views of privacy, will disturb you more or less. But Facebook, for example, through the Facebook button that appears on so many pages on the internet, it's able to basically track your activities all over the internet and keep track of what you're doing and looking at and buying and saying and whatever. And then they also buy these huge data sets, these offline data sets that tell all sorts of stuff about what you do in your offline lives. Like if you bought a pair of shoes at a brick and mortar retailer, you know, that record would be gobbled up by one of these information gathering companies and then aggregated and then sent to bought by Facebook, and they are able to link up the offline and online identities so that they serve you up even more personalized ads. So it might make your online shopping experience more effective, or it can also contribute to you being targeted for, you know, propaganda or fake stories or whatever else people are trying to use Facebook for.
Well, they can use it the more effectively then to grab more of your attention and therefore having you hooked in longer, I guess. And that's seems to be how it's accumulated over the years as well. Like we just become more and more hooked to the phones.
Right, exactly. And I think it is really interesting that we're, it seems like there's this mass consciousness beginning to emerge that, wait a second, this is not all good. You know, as we were talking about many great things about the phones, but something's not quite right about our inability to put them down. I mean, there's a guy who started the, I think it's the Internet Addiction Society. I should look him up. David Greenfield in the States. And he created this test called the smartphone compulsion test. And I put it in my book, and it's 15 questions. You just say yes or no to these questions. I can actually read some of them here. But basically, if you look at these questions, you're like every single person who has a smartphone would score, get a concerning score on this. Like, for example, do you seem to lose track of time when on your smartphone? Yeah. You know, has the amount of time you spend on your smartphone been increasing? Do you sleep with your smartphone turned on under your pillow or next to your bed regularly? I mean, it's just all sorts of questions where you're like, of course. Who doesn't?
Yeah.
Feel reluctant to be without your smartphone for a short time. I mean, like, yes, everyone does. You get totally twitchy.
Absolutely. I think it's different for everyone, isn't it? But certainly for a majority, it seems to be more and more the case. I just look at when we go out and about, you know, guilty as myself, I guess. But, you know, people at restaurants that are sitting there, they're both on their iPhones, or people on the train, you know, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing if they're doing something that's effective. But, you know, it really does take our attention away. And perhaps it's drawing our attention away to things that aren't that important for our lives and our overall well-being. And that's sort of where it runs into the problem, isn't it?
I think that that's exactly right. It's that, you know, there's nothing objectively good or bad about it. I mean, assuming you're not doing anything like to hurt people on the internet, but when you think about the cumulative amount of time you're spending on this, then you start to realize, oh my goodness, you really are losing your life in these little minute by minute chunks. And for me personally, I had a revelation that if the average person spends 4 hours a day on their phone, and I spend less than that, but still, you know, I spend time on my phone, what could you be doing with that time? Like, what could you do with 4 hours a day? And I realized if you put your mind to doing something in particular for 4 hours a day, you can get a lot accomplished. You really could learn stuff or do stuff. I mean, that's half of a workday right there. So for me personally, one of the nice effects of doing this project and spending less time on my phone was to figure out how I wanted to fill up that extra time. And that actually brings up an interesting point that, like, at first, if you actually successfully spend less time on your phone, then you're very likely to actually, I think, become a bit existentially depressed or panicky, because all of a sudden you'll actually find all this time and realize, I don't know what I want to do with it. Like, what do I actually want to do with my time? It's much easier to just, in my case, go on eBay and look for, like, I have a thing for looking for antique hardware, like door hardware for my house. It's weird. But, like, you know, I can whittle away a lot of, or waste a lot of time doing that.
Yeah.
But if I sit down, like my husband and I started doing 24-hour breaks from our phones over the weekends just to see what it was like. And there were several times when I would just sit there and I'd be like, okay, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. How is it only 2 o'clock in the afternoon? And what do I possibly want to do with myself until dinner time? And it was funny and upsetting to a degree to realize it did make me feel a little bit panicky. But then I was able to say, okay, well, what are some things I've always said I wanted to do? And so one thing I always said I wanted to do was learn to play guitar, because I play piano and I love music. And so I ended up finding an adult guitar class and signed up for that. And I've been doing that for almost a year now. And it's been truly amazing. Like, I have a new community of people. I have a teacher I really like. I'm actually learning the guitar. And then when I have these moments where I have some free time on my hands and I ask myself, what would I like to do with this time? It's no longer just scroll through eBay. It's like, I'm going to go practice the guitar and actually feel like I'm improving and getting better and enjoying music, which for me has made a, you know, really added joy to my life in a way that just idling away on my phone doesn't.
Yeah, absolutely. So doing those things, and that makes a lot of sense, you know, figuring out what you want to do. So we just had another bout of poor internet connectivity. I hope it's really not affecting the quality of this interview. Can you hear me okay, Catherine?
I can hear you perfectly, yeah.
Okay. You're coming a little bit robotic.
The phone company recognizing them, suggesting we spend less time on the internet.
Yeah. conspiracy. I had a question there to follow up. What I'm wondering about is, you know, it's 4 hours, but we don't really look at it like 4 hours of chunk time. Like, I don't say, well, from 8 to 12, I've been spending on my phone, because it's really 4 hours accumulated throughout the day. You know, the 10 minutes waiting in the library line, or the 5 minutes while we're, I don't know, stopped in the car, traffic lights throughout the day. All these moments add up to that bigger chunk of time. And those little moments of time may not seem that significant. Yeah, I don't know what sort of research or information you have around this use of our time, but I've really found that just by not picking up my phone at every little moment I have to look at, you know, the Facebook update or mail or whatever it might be, has really allowed me to just be with myself and have that moment of awareness within, you know. And that sort of gives me a greater sense of you know, what's happening in my world and what's out there and all that sort of stuff. And I think that's really important time. But when we look at it, we don't really see it as being much significant time. You know, not a unworthy use of our time, because it's, you know, well, I'm in my car at a traffic light anyway, so why not check my Facebook? Or I'm in the library line or in the bank line, you know, so why not?
Right. Yeah. And I think that's a good point to bring up, is that you have this different ways to look at this. You can look at it as, if you want to make every moment of your day as effective or as enjoyable or fulfilling or whatever as possible. And then, you know, you're like, I'm going to practice guitar for an hour and a half right now, versus, like, as you're saying, I've got 3 minutes on the line of the bank. Like, what else am I going to do? But I would argue that
pull out my guitar and have 3 minutes.
Yeah. But, you know, I would argue, like, And I think this is what you're saying as well, that those small chunks of time, there is also a value in not using your phone, but it's not because you're necessarily going to replace that 3 minutes of phone time with 3 minutes of intense productivity and sales. That 3 minutes can just be time to do nothing, which is something I think we don't really do that much anymore. You know, time to let your mind wander, or time to be bored, or just to be there. I mean, I've started spending bus rides and, like, riding an Uber, like, basically not looking at my phone and just staring out the window. And I found it to be amazingly calming. And I think that's another interesting point, is to, if you think about the brain chemistry that's going on when you check your phone, it is lighting up your dopamine, like, reward circuitry. And you're constantly trying to get a little hit of dopamine, which is a salience neurotransmitter, that every time you check. There's a guy named Tristan Harris who was in the tech world and now speaks out, through this movement called Time Well Spent, basically trying to make people think about all these things. And he talks about how your phone is basically like a slot machine, and you're checking your phone because you're trying to see what's next. And every time you see something new, you're getting this little spritz of dopamine, which is making you feel rewarded for having checked. Mm. And so you have to check it again and again and again. And, you know, when you start thinking about the slot machine analogy, it becomes really disturbing, because slot machines are pretty much the most addictive machine to have been invented. I mean, that's the entire point. So you have this kind of reward circuitry going on. And then you also have this interesting I guess the other side of that, this the stress hormones, is that when you don't check your phone, but you're used to checking your phone, you actually feel a bit of a fight or flight, like stress, you know, adrenaline or cortisol going on that makes you feel anxious. Mm. And so you check your phone so that you'll feel less anxious.
Yep.
Then you have to check it again to continue to keep the anxiety at bay. Or, and I often find this is the case, you look at your phone to reduce your anxiety or to give yourself a reward because you're bored for those 3 minutes in line, and you end up seeing something online that produces more anxiety. Like I have taken news apps off my phone, and I really try not to check it because I'm like, what's the best thing that's going to happen for me checking my phone right now? Am I actually going to feel good as a result of looking at this? And 99.9% of the time, like, I'm not going to feel good. I might feel distracted or amused or whatever, but I'm not, chances are it's going to make me feel a little like anxious, either because I'm going to want to check it again or because I just saw something that made me anxious.
That's a really good point, because it not only, you know, it distracts your attention away from that little moment, wherever that moment might be, but it can last, you know, once you click off again, by whatever your attention was occupied by, you know, that can remain in your thoughts. Right. It might be someone posted something that sort of aggravated you, or it might be something in the news that you saw. It could be anything.
Exactly.
And again, that's dragging your attention and, you know, your own thoughts away from what maybe you want to be thinking about and focusing on.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's also important to recognize that human beings are wired to be distracted, because you want to be distracted, because if there's a threat in your environment, you want to pick up on that. You don't want to be so lost in your, like,
yeah,
cave drawings that you don't notice that, like, a lion or whatever has entered the, I don't know, they always use lions and, like, safety tooth somethings or whatever. You know what I mean? But anyway, you want to, like, be aware enough to be easily distracted so that you don't get caught in a situation where you're going to get killed by nature. So we are automatically wired to be distracted. So I feel like we need to actually be quite protective of our attention, because it's a very, very difficult thing for our minds to do, to stay focused on something. And when we think about focus and attention, we often think about it as the proactive, you know, state of focus, instead of the flip and just as important part of it, which is ignoring everything else. You have to choose what you're going to focus on, and then you have to ignore every single other stimulus that's in your environment, which, if you think about it, is crazy. That's so difficult. And the more time you spend on your phone or on the internet in general, kind of flipping between pages and apps and whatever, the more you're actually training your brain to not be able to ignore those distractions, to pick up on all of these little quick changes and cues. And that's very important for us to start thinking about, because our brains are actually incredibly malleable and plastic. I mean, if you practice something and act in a certain way over and over again, you actually are changing your brain in a way to support that behavior.
Yeah.
And if you think about the fact that our brains by default want to go in the distracted direction, that it's hard to train them to be focused. And then you spend 4 hours a day, it never is 4 hours in a row, as you said, but 4 hours a day basically practicing being distracted. Then there's two forces going in that direction: your brain's natural proclivity for distraction and the fact that you're practicing being distracted. And then you go and try to read a book, and all of a sudden you're like, I can't read a page without wanting to go check something.
Yeah, right. That's so, you know, true. Mm.
I mean, the good side of that is you can get it back. Like, it just takes effort.
Practice,
yeah. And to get back to the mindfulness thing, you know, meditation can be a very powerful tool for that. But the first step in getting that attention span back is actually to recognize what it is that's affecting it, and to also realize that the time you spend on your phone really is doing stuff to your brain. It's not just kind of like passive distraction or just, you know, wasted time, quote unquote, that's not really doing anything good or bad. It actually really is changing your brain.
Yeah, like, I remember when I switched off the TV and stopped watching it, because I used to watch it religiously at nights, you know, news, whatever was on, for probably, you know, from when I got home to when I went to bed, and switching it off just made a huge difference in my life. And then, you know, the phone came in, and I started spending more time on that, and that was everywhere. And, you know, more recently I've been more conscious of my attention to my phone, and I sort of go through a little bit of a cycle. Like right now, I've sort of started to look at my mail a little bit more, you know, when I don't need to. So just things like that. But generally, you know, it's just through practice and constantly reminding myself that I can just continue to remove myself from it. But that probably leads us to the final little part of our interview that I want to talk about, and maybe just a couple of bits of advice and tips on how we can, you know, manage to break up with our phone and build a better relationship.
Well, yeah, and you may have specific questions, but one thing that just sprang to mind as you were saying that is part of reframing that I think is really useful, getting back to what we were saying about how the five tips to spend less time on your phone never really make long-term change.
Yeah.
I think part of it is because we're framing the goal as a negative, to spend less time on our phones, right? It's kind of like punitive in a way, like you're doing something bad. And instead we should be saying, what do we want to our relationship with our phone to be? So instead of saying how can I not check my phone? Like, what times could I resist checking my phone during, right? You could say instead, what times would it feel good not to check my phone? Or what would make me feel good if you're like, I would like to go for a walk and not have my phone on me, because I think that would be a nice thing for myself. Then that's a goal you're much more likely to want to work towards than trying to, I don't know, put a limit on yourself or punish yourself by saying you're not allowed to look at your phone for 1 hour a day just on principle or something like that. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So just reframing the goal of a positive sense rather than
a positive. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like you're saying, I'm not going to allow myself to watch TV just because I'm not going to allow myself to watch TV, but instead saying, I would like to feel more relaxed before bedtime. And I know that if I don't watch TV before bedtime, I'll feel more relaxed. So if I don't watch TV, I'm giving myself the gift of relaxation. Therefore, you have a positive goal that makes you feel like you're doing something nice for yourself instead of just arbitrarily telling yourself you can't do something.
Yeah, there's some science behind, telling yourself that the negative thing that you don't want to do that actually sort of causes you to think about it more and actually therefore have a tendency to behave towards it as well.
Right, exactly. A restriction, and then you want to do it even more.
Yeah, I'm an ex-smoker, so I know the addiction there to smoking, and every time you say, look, it's just a terrible thing, I don't really want to do it, but then you start thinking about it and that causes sort of this anxiety, and then you go, well, I need that cigarette to relieve that anxiety, and it sort of pushes you towards the behavior.
Well, that makes me think. I haven't never been a smoker myself, but with the mindfulness thing, and maybe you're aware of this study already, but there's a very interesting study that I actually mentioned in the phone book about smokers and using mindfulness training as a tool to help people quit. And this meditation neuroscientist named Judson Brewer, who's now at the University of Massachusetts with John Kabat-Zinn, who would be a great guest if you haven't spoken to him. Oh, okay. Yeah. So you probably know this, but he did an intervention with smokers where he used mindfulness training and compared that to the gold standard program for the American Lung Association, and found that training people just to be aware of their actions in the moment and really tuning into the taste of the cigarette and the smell of their clothes afterwards and what they were doing, that actually was a far more effective way and long lasting way to get people to quit. So I thought that was really interesting, considering that, for as addictive as our phones are, they're not as addictive as cigarettes, I don't think. So if it works for cigarettes, it's pretty strong indication to me that mindfulness and using similar techniques really can help us alter our behaviors around our phones.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I started mindfulness sort of meditation a few years back, unknowingly what I was doing, and just sort of it started feeling good. So I kept doing it and kept practicing and increasing it and stuff like that. And certainly I've found in the last as I've been doing it, I've really improved my awareness and really been able to have a higher level of attention to what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, and really been able to, not avoid the things that I really don't want to do. It's brought a lot of attention and benefits to my life, and it seems to be accumulating at a faster rate.
Yeah, I think it's really powerful for behavior change. Like, I have type 1 diabetes, and so if I eat carbohydrates, I just basically will mess up my blood sugar. So if I'm faced with a tempting carbohydrate, it's very helpful for me to take a step back and be mindful of, okay, what am I doing? Do I really want to eat that? Is that really worth the consequences I know I'm going to face later and how I'm going to feel later? And a lot of times it's like, I actually am not craving that much. That was more of just a ingrained behavior that is like automatic to want to eat that. And if I actually think about it, I don't want to do it. And it becomes a much easier, it doesn't feel like I'm fighting against myself. It makes me feel like I've just recognized a desire that I didn't realize was there.
And do you feel that comes more of a natural process rather than a conscious, I'm pulling myself away and focusing my awareness onto this one thing. If that makes sense. More of a, just it's subconsciously starts to happen more and more, where I just seem to be more mindful about what I'm doing, even though I'm not really consciously focusing my attention on it.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like tuning into what your actual desires are for yourself, where you have different layers of desires that you think you want to check your phone, but if you tap into yourself and you think, okay, but how does that actually make me feel? And do I really want to pick up my phone right now? Like, what's that going to make me feel or do? Or, you know, and then you're suddenly like, oh no, the real like me inside doesn't want to do that. So I don't have to do that. And it's not a, as you're saying, it's not a restriction then. It's actually doing exactly what you truly want to do, but it took a bit to recognize what you truly wanted to do. Because your automatic behavior might have been the opposite, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And you know it's an addiction too. When people, you know, we know what we should be doing or what we don't want to be doing. And even with that good judgment or rationality, we still go towards a thing that we don't want to be doing.
And for me, another aspect of the mindfulness that I always found really useful was the idea of recognizing that, and this is kind of exactly what we're talking about, but that your mind is not you. Like your mind has a mind of its own, you know, so your mind is constantly presenting you with these, I like to think of them as, you know, invitations to parties. Like, do you want to have the email party right now? Do you want to like get pissed off because someone cut you off in traffic? Like that's an option. And what we don't realize is that we actually get to decide whether or not we want to say yes to those invitations. Just because your mind is presenting you with the desire to pick up your phone right now does not mean that you have to say yes to it. And for me, at least, that's a very useful technique to recognize when all these desires come up or these thoughts or feelings or whatever, that it's my mind inviting me to do or feel something. But you know, my mind can also be kind of crazy or has really bad ideas. And so I don't actually have to always listen to it, but it takes that kind of cultivation of mindfulness and awareness to be able to separate those invitations from your true desires and true self.
Yeah. And what's really fascinating is that, you know, even those, the mind that gives us that invitation and it seems like it's so inviting and we know that we don't want to, you know, accept the invite, but it feels like that if we don't, we're going to be in some sort of significant level of pain. The mind's tricking us that, you know, we're going to experience some deeper level of suffering. And so we go, oh, better, you know, do it anyway. And it's just so not like we don't actually, it's all just an accumulation of the mind just trying to force us into that behavior.
Yeah, it's true. It's like, you know, you feel like you're going to, and a lot of the anxiety hormones and things like that contribute to it, where it's like, you better check your email. Don't you want to check your email? And it's like, because if you don't check your email, you're going to miss something important. And you're like, okay, mind, I'll do it. But then in reality, you think about it, what are you going to miss? You're probably not going to miss very much.
You don't go through pain. There's no pain to it other than what you're thinking is painful.
Right.
Does that make sense? Like when I was giving up cigarettes, and again, I'm a recent ex-smoker, yeah, so I'm quite conscious of this. But you know, we just as it's a tough addiction. It's a freaking hard addiction, and to stop it, you think you're going to go through some level of pain. But the truth is, once you get your mindset right, there is just absolutely no pain to it. Like nicotine, the drug itself, is very, very unpainful in the withdrawal part of you know, giving up cigarettes. And it's so true. Like once you get your mindset around that, there is no pain in the withdrawal part of giving up cigarettes. And it can actually be quite pleasurable.
That's interesting. Like, yeah, that's a very good analogy. Yeah, similar to the phone. I have a friend who's a psychiatrist who was instrumental in, like, you know, bouncing ideas off through this process. And he was like, well, the good thing about the phone addiction is that while it can be very powerful in the moment, it actually is not that hard of an addiction to break, because even more so than cigarettes, like it's not a painful thing.
No, it's not like someone's cutting off your leg and you're going through 3 weeks of pain. No, it's really not. It's nothing like that.
It's very, very mental.
It's all a mental pain, I guess, which can be hard to tackle. But once you sort of get your mind around that, it makes it a little bit easier, I think. Really interesting conversation. I know there's probably a lot more that we could discuss about your book, but let's encourage the audience to go up and grab a copy. This will be released, in the next few weeks, I guess, from the time this podcast is released. So perfect timing. So guys, check that out and check out Catherine at catherineprice.com. Is that correct, Catherine?
It's catherine-price.com. I think catherineprice.com is an acupuncturist who looks like vaguely like me. So she seems to have a wonderful practice also, but it's not me. You could also look at howtobreakupwithyourphone.com, which will send you to the right site.
Okay. Yeah, I've got it here, catherine-price.com. Yep, I'll stick that in the show notes, guys. Plus all the links that we've talked about in this show. There's an app there that I certainly want to check out because I'm curious to see how much time I'm spending on my phone, which was Moments. I'll stick that in the show notes as well. Catherine, I've got a few more questions that I ask all guests. Are you happy to stick around for these?
Sure.
All right, let me find them. So the first question I want to ask you, which is probably one you can answer pretty easily. Do you have any routines or rituals you believe contribute to your success?
I actually found that to be a hard one to answer. Oh. This was fodder for conversation between me and my husband last night at dinner because Lee sent me these questions. So, which actually I shouldn't say because I'm not going to sound like I've got good answers. So I didn't get through them all. But rituals are, I think that getting my phone out of the picture is very useful. And then this sounds like so boring, but I think getting enough sleep for me is actually the most important ritual or routine I need to do in order to be productive in anything, because I cannot function if I don't have at least 8 or 8.5 hours of sleep.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely important. And it seems to be doing a little bit of a backflip at the moment, this whole sleep thing, because for a while it was hustle and I'll sleep when I'm dead. But now it seems to be a lot more information coming out there about why it is so important that we sleep. Yes. And why it actually might extend your life if you just slept a little bit more, which I'm guilty of not right. sleeping enough. That's a good one. What advice would you give your 20-year-old self?
Well, that was another interesting one. So I think I would say to my 20-year-old self, stay the course, like have faith in yourself because you will be able to carve out a niche for yourself. My goal, and I know that you're interested in like definitions of success. My definition of success was always to basically be paid for being me. And I do feel like I'm doing that now, which I'm very happy about. But I certainly have had a lot of anxiety along the way. And I think that I would have told my 20-year-old self to, well, first of all, be kinder to herself because I had all sorts of like self-hatred issues going on. And and also to kind of stay true to stay the course. I also think I would have suggested to her, though, that she expand her horizons of what those courses could be. Because, for example, I think that I'm a entrepreneur by nature, but I didn't really know anything about starting a business or that even was an avenue I could have pursued. I was always very much encouraged to be a writer, and that's what I've done, and I love it. But I also have this like desire to start businesses or to create things, and I also really do like leading people and working with people. And as a freelance journalist, you really are very isolated. So anyway, so I guess stay the course, but do more research in terms of what those courses could be, and then don't hate yourself so much. It's not worth it.
Good stuff. So your definition of success is to be paid to be you?
For me, yeah, I think that. Well, I guess if I were to refine that a bit more, that was my goal as a career, to be paid for to be me. I would say for me, success is certain degree of stability. I think that if I don't feel like financially secure, then it's hard to feel successful. But then I would go beyond that to say, if I'm excited about what I'm doing when I wake up in the morning, that seems like a sign of success.
Absolutely.
Or excited about the people I'm spending time with.
You seem very grounded and, yourself, I suppose, just in speaking with you today. So,
well, that's nice.
Hats off to you. Well, it's hard, I think, for a lot of people to really just be their vulnerable self, isn't it? Which is probably a topic for another day. But yeah, you definitely come across that way anyway in speaking with you. What is your number one piece of productivity advice?
Well, in a very literal sense, and as a tip that people could use for themselves, I would say making a few adjustments to your computer, which for me was installing a Gmail plugin called Inbox When Ready. There's also one called Boomerang that does something similar, but basically it sounds so simple, but it just doesn't tell you when you have new messages unless you proactively tell it to tell you of new messages. And as an email addict myself, that basically made it possible for me to write this book because I wrote it in 6 months. And if I had been responding to every email in my inbox, I would have never made it. So that was enormous. With the slight caveat that I now have something like 150 emails in my inbox dating back to August. And I'm totally stressed out about trying to answer them, but I got more productive. And then the other thing is an app blocker called Freedom. And you can use Freedom. It syncs across devices if you use Apple products, and you can tell Freedom what apps and what websites you don't want access to during what periods of time. And so if you have like a penchant for checking the news before bed or social media before bed, and you know you don't want to do that, and you know it makes you feel bad, but you know you're going to do it anyway, you can set Freedom so that it just won't let you do it. And then you try to do it, and this green screen pops up with a butterfly, and it just says you're free from this site, and you actually feel good about it.
That's interesting.
And like, yes. So that I think actually is a great productivity tool because you can say, I don't have the access to the internet for the next 2 hours. So anytime I click over out of habit, it's just going to tell me I can't see it. And that is a huge productivity helper.
Now, I'd be one of those people, this is just my nature, but I'd be one of those people to go, you know what, I'm going to go into this Freedom app and unblock that app so I can use it right now.
But see, there's a thing you can do to go in there to make it So yes, they have a feature for people like you.
Good on them.
Makes it really impossible to actually stop the session once you start it. So
I can actually lock myself out permanently. Yes. Wow. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, you'll never access the internet again.
What advice would you give someone looking to make some change in their life?
Oh, that one we didn't get to over dinner last night, so I've got to think about that one a bit.
Turn off your phone.
Turn off your phone.
Seems to be cliche, doesn't it?
Advice for making it. I guess, okay, I'm going to use a piece of advice I heard from someone who runs a summer camp, and we were talking about how they decide what programming to do, and she talked about something called the OHM method, which was outcomes before methods. And so basically the idea being, what do you want the outcome to be from this change? Like, what do you want to feel a different way? Do you want to be creating something different? Do you want to be working with different people? Like, try to figure out what you want the outcome to be, and then you can determine what the method for that change should be.
Yeah. Okay. Good point.
You know, maybe it's not quitting your job. Maybe it's that you want to be a writer. So the outcome, you want to be writing something. So you could be doing something like a blog or something else that's not actually going to destroy your paycheck. And the change you think you're going to make might not actually result in the outcome you think that you actually want, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Which is often the case, better, I think. Yeah. We're often pretty drastic to act.
Yeah.
Dramatically, before we actually think about what we actually want. So that's a good
point. I had another suggestion, another person for you to interview. I would say read Designing Your Life, which is a book by Dave Evans and Bill Buford, I think. These professors at Stanford who teach design courses, and they wrote this amazing book that uses design principles to help you determine how to design your life, basically. And they have a lot of really helpful exercises in there for people who are looking to make a change and to live a more meaningful and fulfilling life.
Okay. What's that, Design in Your Life?
Designing Your Life. Yeah.
Okay. I might put that up. I've got a question, your favorite book. So I might put that under there for you guys listening out there. Yeah.
That's excellent.
Who's that by? Evan who?
It's Dave Evans. And I want to say Bill Buford, but I may be getting his...
Okay. Okay, I'll stick it in the notes. That's cool. What's your favorite food?
Strawberries.
Yep. Favorite leisure activity?
At the moment, it's guitar, I guess. And spending time with my daughter, too. And husband.
Favorite quote?
Well, I like that your life is what you pay attention to. That's kind of one of my favorites right now.
Who's that by?
Many people. I mean, that version is what I use in the book, but the whole principle of attention, I mean, the most common reference is William James and the Principles of Psychology from 1890, but that one's written in a very 1890s kind of way.
Okay. And do you believe we all have a why?
No. I think you need to find your why.
Yeah. Okay. And what do you believe, or what does living life with passion and purpose mean to you?
Well, I guess that kind of gets back to the idea of doing things that make you excited and happy in the moment. I mean, I think the point of my life, at least, it's I want to be fulfilled in the moment, because the moments are all that we have. And so for me, passion and purpose is figuring out how to feel as much of those emotions, I guess, in my day-to-day experience, and not just slogging through the days with some future vision of those things.
Yeah.
Just recognizing, you know, this is what we have. So make it as good as you can.
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah. And I don't, this is kind of a new question. I don't know how to word it correctly, but I'll give it a whack. And that is, what do you believe is your underlying motivation to everything you do?
Well, for my writing, I think it would be to make people think about things differently, and also to make them laugh. And I wouldn't say necessarily that this book is a hysterically funny book, but I think that bringing pleasure and enjoyment to people and then making them look at things a little bit differently.
Okay. And why is that important to you?
I think that is a way to see things more clearly. I like trying to help people see things from a little bit different of a perspective. So maybe they'll or we all can evaluate our own beliefs a bit more, I guess. I mean, what comes to mind is that my previous book was, it's called Vitamania, How Vitamins Revolutionize the Way We Think About Food. And it's all about the history of vitamins and nutrition and basically looking at like, how did we actually come to the point where in the States, at least we're like popping all these supplements or we've got such strongly held beliefs about these particular substances. And by presenting this historical thing and, you know, through my writing, I hoped to give people the material and substance and knowledge necessary to question their own beliefs a bit.
Yeah. So look, you know, helping other people in that sense is huge and just, you know, greatly beneficial, really helping other people think differently and you know, giving them that bit of education as well, I suppose is really powerful. To you personally, how does that, you know, affect your life, or how does that benefit you? Why is that so important and something you wish to do and occupy your attention with?
I think it's probably a number of reasons, partially because I see things in a weird way a lot of the time, and it's probably in some degree, you know, satisfying to me to not feel like such a weirdo. So like, be like, no, I'm not crazy. See, look, this is, but I mean, I think also the things that bring me the most joy are bringing people together and spending moments together. And I feel like through my writing, you know, sometimes I get notes from people, sometimes you get nasty notes, but I recently received like a really nice note from some guy about an article I wrote about a Vitamix, which is a high powered blender. And he said, I was just reading your article and I was laughing out loud and I had to read some parts to my wife because I was enjoying it so much. And I just wanted to send you a note to thank you for being such a, you know, it's so nice to read something well written and to laugh. And that just made me so happy because I felt like I had connected with this person and brought him a bit of joy. And then in a different example would be, I, as I said, I have type 1 diabetes. I was diagnosed when I was 22 and I wrote a piece that ended up in the New York Times Well blog that was about what it's like to have type 1 diabetes. And it was called Thinking About Diabetes with Every Bite. And it was about the relationship with food that this disease makes you have. And I've gotten such wonderful, moving feedback from other people with type 1 diabetes or parents of people with type 1 diabetes saying, I've tried to explain this disease to my friends and family and colleagues, and I never could really put the experience into words. And your essay did that, and I'm printing it out, and I'm sharing it with my loved ones so that they can understand my experience better. And to me, that was just so wonderful to think that I had the ability to take an experience that other people had and communicate it and get it down on paper in a way that helped them communicate that to other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect. You've answered my question in there, and there's two words that certainly seem to be the underlying motivation is that drive towards joy and happiness. And that's probably where I was sort of going with the question without sort of triggering the question. I think that's the motivation for all of us is that deep sense of joy and happiness in life. And we often don't make that connection, but once we do, we can figure out, you know, what we're doing and why we're doing it and how it relates to us going on that path towards joy and happiness. And if it's not, perhaps then we can, you know, break free and do other things with our time.
Yes.
So, lovely interview. Thank you for coming on the show once again. Best way to reach out to you again is Catherine-Price.com, and also the book link, which is How to Break Up With Your Phone, .com, I suppose. I'll stick it in the show notes, guys. So for you listening out there, jump on, check Catherine out. Thank you for coming on the show and make sure you pick up a copy of her book. Catherine, any final words?
No, just thank you very much for the opportunity, and you gave me some things to think about too.
It's been a pleasure. Absolutely. Let's stay connected and we'll talk at the other end, guys. Check it all out, thehiddenwhite.com. Until next time, peace, passion and purpose. See you soon. There you have it, guys, my interview with Catherine Price. What did you think? I absolutely loved it. I thought it was awesome and a really good reminder to just think about how we're using our phones, how much we're using it, why we're using it, and perhaps how better we could utilize our time and maybe even just try and work to remove those moments of distraction, remove that need to constantly be fidgeting and doing stuff with our phone and find peace and joy in, you know, our own minds, in reflecting and awareness and just in life in general. I think we can maximize the moments more fully if we're not constantly being distracted by our phones and other things that are slowly encroaching and consuming our lives. So anyway, if you're here, guys, I assume you made it through the audio. I do apologize for the poor quality today. I'll improve my game from here on, but I appreciate your patience with that as well. Guys, if you'd like to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. You can leave us a review on iTunes. You can share any of the episodes that you've heard through the social media platforms and the links provided on the platform that you're listening to this show on. You can connect with me and Catherine. Let us know what you think about our conversation through the comments section at thehiddenwire.com or by reaching either of us directly through our websites. Other than that, guys, I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Breathe more passion into every single moment. Do everything with greater purpose, and in doing so, discover your hidden why. That's it from me, guys. Until next time, see you later. Bye.